The argument from petition.
May it please the court, Mr. Frederick Chapman will present argument from petition.
May it please the court, I appear here today on behalf of Tarrant County and her Commissioner's Court, asking this court to reverse for errors of law the decision of the Court of Appeals in Fort Worth, Texas. This case involves basic and fundamental principles of the organic law of this state. In 1980, the Commissioner's Court of Tarrant County undertook for the first time in over 100 years a wholesale revision of the justice precincts of Tarrant County. The Commissioner's Court, exercising the authority given to it under Article 5, Section 18 of the Constitution, determined that all the justice precincts and the justice of the peace places therein, in order to serve the convenience of the people of Tarrant County, must be abolished. And they did so. Then the Commissioner's Court established 8 new justice precincts, with 1 justice of the peace in each of those. Subsequently, this change was submitted to the United States Department of Justice for approval pursuant to Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Approval was obtained after the November 80 general election. After approval was received, the plaintiffs in this case, 4 justices of the peace and constables, brought suit against the Commissioner's Court and against the county. Subsequently, the other 14 office holders or potential office holders were made parties to the action. Trial was commenced following other proceedings that took place in the United States District Court for the Northern District of Texas. Essentially, it is the claim of the Commissioner's Court and the county that the Constitution vests in the Commissioner's Court the authority to abolish the justice precincts and to abolish the offices of justice of the peace. We believe that the law clearly supports this exercise of power. The county and the Commissioner's Court bring before this court 3 points of error. First being that there is no evidence to support any finding that these plaintiffs were denied due process of law. The second, that under no circumstances may the county be held liable for exercising the power granted to it under Article 5, Section 18. And third, that the judgment that was rendered, if the county and the Commissioner's Court are incorrect in their first 2 points of errors, is so vague and indefinite that there is no way that the county can ascertain the extent of its liability. The Court of Appeals, with regard to due process, stated that there were some 7 elements that must be complied with in order to accord these justices of the peace and constables due process of law. They listed notice of the time and place of the meeting, notice of the specific subject matter of the meeting, notice of the right to appear, of the justices and office holders to defend their rights and to show cause why their offices should not be abolished. We believe that the record in this case is clear, that notice was indeed given to the justices of the peace and to the constables of the time and place and location of the meeting, the subject matter of the meeting, and of their right to appear. There were 4 other elements that the Court of Appeals indicated that must be given in order for someone to be accorded due process. they must be notified that there is a possibility that their office, that their vested rights in their office may be affected. They must be notified that there is an absence of an assurance that they would retain an office. They must be notified that there is a possibility that none would be reappointed, which appears merely to be a restatement of the previously mentioned point. And finally, that there is a possibility that they would no longer receive their salary and benefits, which again appears to be merely a restatement of previous elements. All of those matters are matters of law, of which we believe all of the citizens of this state, including these office holders, are charged with knowledge. We do not believe that there is any requirement of due process that you give notice to the other side of the exactly what the law is. In this instance, you would have laymen, commissioner's court members, or a clerk of the commissioner's court attempting to give legal advice to justices of the peace and constables. And clearly we think that those elements are not called for. Clearly, we believe that the elements that of due process that they are entitled to, they received. They received notice, they received opportunity to be heard, and indeed, they did testify, they did speak to the commissioner's court at various times and places. Every plaintiff who was on the stand mentioned their attendance at one or more of these meetings, the fact that they were allowed to ask any questions they wanted to ask, there were people there to answer the questions that they had, they were allowed to address the commissioner's court. Plaintiff Ashmore indeed presented alternatives to the commissioner's court, which was not adopted. 33 years ago, an opinion was rendered by the Attorney General of this state, Mr. Price Daniel, who subsequently came to serve on this court. Opinion number V790. The first assistant attorney general, who signed on that opinion and indicated his approval, is now the chief justice of this court. In that opinion, the attorney general was asked whether a commissioner's court acting under the authority of the constitutional article section 5 article 5 section 18 has the authority to abolish existing justice court precincts and create a new justice court precinct of territory engrossed of the territory formerly consisting of the justice precincts so abolished. The attorney general responded that the commissioner's court did have that power, and in doing so relied heavily upon the opinion of the Texas Court of State, Ex rel. Dowden versus Rigsby, which we have cited and quoted somewhat extensively in our petition to this court. The Dowden case, I believe, is also important in that case reached this court. The Chief Justice, in refusing case rule of error, noted that the court had some doubts as to its jurisdiction, but that having examined the case upon its merits, finds that it is in all manners correct, and therefore the application for writ of error will be refused.
Say that again, please.
I'm sorry. In the Dowland case, the report of the refusal of the application for writ of error is found at 43 Southwest, page 1101.
Is it a per curiam opinion?
Your Honor, the notation is Gaines CJ, and it says the Court of Civil Appeals were inclined to doubt whether this proceeding was authorized by law, and we are disposed to agree with them. Growing out of that question is another as to the jurisdiction of this court. But having examined the case upon its merits, we are clearly of the opinion that it was correctly decided in the Court of Civil Appeals. In any event, the application must be refused, The result being necessarily the same, we refuse the application without passing upon either of the jurisdictional questions. In the opinion of the Attorney General, V790, again, there is an extensive quotation from State Ex Rel Dowlin versus Rigsby. The Attorney General comes to the conclusion that the Commissioner's Court may indeed abolish the justices, the precincts, and the offices therein. The Attorney General concludes that the terms of office of all officers of such abolished and changed precincts will ipso facto terminate, and the officers of the newly created precincts must be appointed by the Commissioner's Court. I believe that this case presents to this court the question of the nature and extent of the property interest of an office holder of an office of justice of the peace or constable in that office. Clearly, it is a property interest which the people of this state and its courts will protect from an interloper. However, it is the fundamental and organic law of this state that it is people who decide the form of their government. The expression they have given is in the Constitution. A justice of the peace and a constable holds his office at the sufferance, if you will, of the Commissioner's Court because the people of this state have vested in their Commissioner's Courts of the several counties the authority from time to time for the convenience of the people to make such changes as are necessary in those precincts. The people have placed upon the Commissioner's Courts limitations. Those limitations are that the Commissioner's Court may not create less than 4 precincts, nor more than 8 precincts. The other limitation is that if there is a city of 8,000 or more wholly contained within any one justice precinct, then there must be 2 justices of the peace within that precinct. In State Ex Rel Dowlin versus Rigsby, the court held that the provision in the Constitution establishing the term of the justices of the peace and of the constables was not a limitation upon this power. In viewing the property interest of a justice of peace or a constable on his office, first must be kept in mind the fact that justices of the peace and constables run at different times and their terms overlap. Therefore, there is no point in time at which a commissioner's court of any county of this state can act to abolish the precincts and change the structure of its government in the manner that the Constitution prescribes and empowers it to do without interrupting the term of at least one group of those offices. It is possible to so time the abolition and recreation of new precincts as to affect all of the office holders or to affect merely one group of office holders. Further, the Constitution vests in the Commissioner's Court the power to fill vacancies in the Office of Justice of the Peace. The Constitution does not vest power in the Commissioner's Court to fill vacancies in the office of constable that is given by statute. Now, we believe that the nature of the property interest that a justice of the peace holds and a constable holds in his office is very much akin to a life estate pure autre vie. My French or Latin may be bad, in which one has a property interest which the state will protect against interlopers, but the interest that you have is dependent upon the things that happen or may happen to another or by another. The questions in this case are at the very heart, we believe, of the constitutional structure of this state. We now know in Tarrant County that the people may vote by a margin of 6-1 in favor of abolishing the office of county treasurer, and that will be ineffective. And the legislature can authorize them to do that, and that still is ineffective, because the county treasurer is constitutional office. His term is set in the Constitution. There is no provision in the Constitution that would allow the office of county treasurer to be abolished in any county of this state. The same is not true of the justice of the peace or of the constable, for the Constitution very clearly vests the power in the commissioner's court to alter and to abolish those precincts from time to time for the convenience of the people.
Well, I don't know this is for the Grant versus Ammerman.
I suspected, Your Honor, that that would be one case that you would bring up. Well, I saw your name prominently mentioned in every aspect of Grant versus Ammerman. Now, Grant versus Ammerman and its variations, Stevens versus Link, I believe there were indeed two Grant versus Ammerman. Those cases involved the question of whether there must be two justices of the peace in a precinct that wholly contains a city of more than 8,000. Those cases did not involve the question of the power of the commissioner's court to alter and abolish the justice precinct.
I thought that's what it did.
Well, as I recall, the Grant Ammerman, I believe there are three and there may be four reported decisions that involve all of that. The courts were looking at that point at a different aspect of Article 5, Section 18, and that is the requirement of the number of justices of peace in a given precinct based on the populations of the cities that may be wholly contained therein.
That's right. Marshall had two, and the commissioner's court decided they were going to abolish one of them.
That is correct. Now, the Constitution says that if you have a city of 8,000 or more, Grant versus Ammerman puts in the wholly contained within a city, within a single justice precinct, the Constitution places upon the commissioner's court an obligation to have two justices of the peace within that precinct. And it says that if the Constitution says there are two within that precinct, and if they do not change the precinct, if they leave it the way it is, they simply cannot abolish the second office. The questions here are not those raised in Grant versus Ammerman and Stevens versus Link, but here the question is, with the first part, if you will, of Article 5, Section 18, which is at the very heart of the power of the Commissioner's Court to make these changes. Now, the respondents have relied heavily upon the case of McGuire versus Hughes, which is a no-writ case decided by the Dallas Court of Civil Appeals in 1970. There, we had an original mandamus proceeding in the Court of Appeals to compel the omission of a justice of the peace from a ballot. This was granted. In Grayson County, Texas, the Commissioner's Court abolished Place 2 in Precinct 1, Justice of Peace Place 2. During the term of the Justice of the Peace Place 1, Precinct 1, the court in McGuire versus Hughes held that the action of the Commissioner's Court in abolishing one office does not change the term of the other. And with that holding, the county does not disagree. Here, however, we have not a single precinct, but an entire county that is affected, where we abolish not just one office, but all of the offices. In McGuire versus Hughes, there is no question raised there as to the power of the Commissioner's Court to abolish the office that it did abolish. The we believe that the Court of Appeals erred in its long listing of the requirements of due process. Mr. Justice Barrow, when he was the sitting on the Court of Civil Appeals in San Antonio, in the case of Villanueva versus Harville, a case which did not reach this court, was decided in 1967, was confronted with an appeal from a denial of mandamus to compel the Commissioner's Court to set aside an order abolishing places in one of Jim Wells County and creating a new Precinct 1 with a single Justice of the Peace. The Justice of the Peace in Place 1 was not appointed as the new Justice of the Peace. Justice of the Peace Place 2 was appointed. In that case, the question was presented as to the due process of law. And Ms. Villanueva claimed she was denied. There, the court said that the plaintiff was present, testified before the Commissioner's Court. The matter had been under consideration for many months. It was well known. There was a good deal of publicity about it, that the plaintiff presented petitions, an alternative, if you will, to the Commissioner's Court. The court said that they were accorded due process of law, a situation remarkably similar to what happened in this case. Now, if Tarrant County cannot abolish the offices of Justice of Peace, Constable, within the precinct, under the power given to it in Article 5, Section 18, without paying for the privilege of doing so, then all counties in this state find themselves in a situation where the justices of peace, in essence, will control the question of whether or not there will be a reorganization, because if commissioners cannot exercise their power without paying for the privilege, then we, in essence, amend the Constitution to say, from time to time, for the convenience of the people, but not for the inconvenience of the office holder. The offices of this state, be they justice of peace, constable, justice of this court, district attorney, county attorney, whatever it may be, are established to serve the people of this state. They are governed by the organic law of this state, the Constitution. The Constitution vests the authority in the Commissioner's Court to make such changes as it deems necessary from time to time for the convenience of the people. The Constitution, in essence, gives the Commissioner's Court the power to interrupt the term of office of a justice of the peace or a constable for the convenience of the people, not for the convenience of the office holder. I will only briefly point out to the court that the judgment that has been rendered in this case requires the Commissioner's Court from time to time to pay the sitting justices of the peace and constables who have not been reappointed to an office their salary and benefits, whatever those benefits may be, that they otherwise might have received. The county has no way of knowing at this point what benefits it is that we are speaking of. There are indeed some benefits that come with the office. One is being called Your Honor. Another is the opportunity to participate in a retirement system. There is insurance. There is no way to tell whether the county must buy insurance for these people. If they die during the course of their term of office, is the county then required to pay a death benefit to them? There is some testimony, but in the record by then-Judge Ashmore about what he earned from fees for marriage ceremonies. He was asked how much did he earn. I believe his response was that he reported several thousand dollars to the Internal Revenue Service. As to the other justices of the peace, we have no idea what benefits it was that the court requires us to pay, nor is the Commissioner's Court in any position to determine with any exactitude how much their liability is, because the budget for these offices is set year to year. And there, it is possible, I suppose, under this judgment for the Commissioner's Court to simply lower the salaries of all of the offices to to the minimum allowed by law and reduce their liability under this judgment. That I don't think that's what the court had in mind, but we're not sure. We believe that their error has been committed and that this case must be reversed. I thank the court for its indulgence.
Thank you, counsel. The court will take a brief recess.
The audience will please rise.
It had nothing to do with granting this writ. I didn't even remember. Go ahead.
The respondents were represented by Jim Clunch, Mr. Charles Dickens, and Mr. R. Edwin Pierce. Arguments will be presented by Mr. Jim Clunch.
You have three arguments?
No, sir. Mr. Jim Clunch and Mr. Charles Dickens will present arguments, and Mr. Clunch will open.
Okay.
May it please the court. I represent Bob Ashmore, T.M. Sheffield, and Bobby O. Blevins, who were justices of the peace. They had been elected in Tarrant County. They were serving office. They were in the midst of a four-year term when this redistricting occurred. I also represent Bruce Lee and Herman Daniels, who were constables. They were elected to new four-year terms at the time the redistricting had occurred. Due process would seem to me to mean an opportunity to notice, an opportunity to be heard, and some fundamental rights accorded to you, among those the right to cross-examine, present your evidence at a hearing. I don't think any of these was done, and I don't think any such contention is made that they had such rights here. Furthermore, it seems to me if you're talking about due process and you're talking about taking my property, And if an elected office is a property right, and I've cited your cases saying that it is, don't you have to pay me to take the property right? Can you just come out and take something that belongs to me and say, we gave you a hearing, you got due process, huh? Go away. Don't believe that's the law in the state. Now, as far as a couple of cases cited to you, I'd like to take on one of those right now, and that's that Dowling versus Rigsby case, the old case. You know, that went up, there's a case that went all the way to the Supreme Court that we've cited to you, Harris County Commissioner's Court down there in Houston. And I've got some pretty good friends on my side who say that's not the law of the state of Texas. That's the Supreme Court of the United States. And they say that, and they say that that case is no longer the law in the state of Texas. Now, I know that sometimes up here I feel totally inadequate, but with that sort of authority behind me, I feel like maybe I'm right this time. That maybe that's not the law here. If the Supreme Court...
Are they quoting something and saying that, or they just say it's not the law?
They cite these cases, Judge.
I'm not over-enthused about them saying what the law affects me, to be honest with you.
All right. I'm not over-enthused about them redistricting of the lines either, Judge. But anyway, the state Supreme Court approved, and I do cite some cases to you in there in my brief, Your Honor, to make that short. The Childress v. County v. Soxie case, some of those that follow along that line. But I also want to state to you that there's been mentioned to you an Attorney General's opinion. But I cite another one to you that's after that, that says that you can't do that. You can't redistrict and take this man's property. And that's that opinion number H564 in 1975. Attorney General again. Saying...
56 what?
564.
That's J.P. Constable.
Yes, sir. Did you say, does that apply to justice, peace, and color? Yes, sir, Judge. That's exactly what it's talking about. It says, in that opinion, the Attorney General stated that the Commissioner's Court could create a new justice of the precinct out of a portion of an existing precinct and appoint a person to fill the new office provided that the proposed change is not intended to affect the incumbent justice of the peace except by changing the boundaries of his precinct. And then it goes on to say, we have held the justice of the peace who have been elected full term and entitled to serve that term, and that a redistricting of their precincts by the Commissioner's Court resulting in a justice not living in the precinct does not vacate his office. Bam. Now those...
Well, I'm in the dark about that Attorney General's opinion, too. Does it overrule 790?
I don't know that it... I'd hesitate to say that it referred to 790. It's certainly after 790.
Who is H? Who wrote it? John Hill?
John Hill.
Okay.
Yeah, you caught me off guard. I could have...
Most Attorney Generals start their opinions... number after their last
after
name.
After the last name.
Last annual was different. He used a V.
I see. All right. But now, it would seem to me then that the law is clearly with the justices of the peace and the constables with whom I represent here before you at this time. These are the cases that are current cases. These are the cases that apply the law. Now, as far as the judgment itself as being uncertain, seems to me there's a very simple way to determine what these men are owed. They ask the auditor employed by the county, what are we owed? And I just suspicion that that's already budgeted to be set aside because it's a very simple formula to follow. As far as the insurance and the benefits, we brought Mr. Leland Mundy, I believe his name will appear in the record, and he testified what you'd receive in the way of insurance benefits and retirement benefits and so on in the record. So I think that the law is, when you talk about judgments, that which can be made certain by reference to other things is ascertainable. You know, it's just like what you see so much of, and I think the court went to the trouble to spell it out for us one time about how you can recover attorney's fees without making your judgment indefinite and so on. And I think you have the same thing here. But it seems to me we have a very fundamental proposition here And that is, I too know that these are Justice Peace Office is a constitutional office, and that you cannot, in the state of Texas, we talk about the process of what the people want. The people vote and elect these folks, and if you want to take them out of office, I think the Constitution provides the ways for that. Now, I'm not going to make a long speech to you on the process, but you know well the process is there to remove anybody from office. If there are proper ways to do it. Just to say we decide that we don't want you in this office and we're going to abolish these offices is not a proper way. I think those are the three points before the court.
Counselor, yes? Is it your position that, I assume the justices of the peace are staggered in Tarrant County like most of them?
Yes.
Not all of them are up at the same time for re-election?
That's correct, yes.
Is it your position that to redistrict countywide at any time, those who have 2 years to go are going to have to be paid?
That's correct.
If they're districted to get out of their office?
That is correct. Now, that you say, well, that involves an expenditure of money. That's only happened one time in 100 years, it's been pointed out. And yes, it involves an expenditure of money, but the expenditure of money is to see that due process of law is accorded to the office holder as well. And I think that's well worth whatever expense it is.
Okay. So what you're saying is you just really can't take a man's job away from him during his term of office. You can provide lines to be changed at the end of his term, or you just decide to pay him.
That's correct. I think you have to pay him to save his profit.
Is your person on a salary?
They have salaries set, and I believe the salaries are set by the county commissioners.
Salaries plus fees?
They were entitled to certain fees, such as marriage.
JPs in Harris County make more money than any judges in the state, it's my understanding, on marriage fees.
I'm not sure that that is correct. If so, I'm going
to
have to
make more in Fort Worth.
If that is true, I'm going to have to renegotiate my contract and my time. But I don't think that's true. I don't believe that's true.
And the county would owe however many marriages a man can break up, or woman?
I
said, and the county would owe the JP however many marriages
he would perform.
A woman JP would have made, or just the salary?
I think the salaries is what the evidence accorded.
It's a tail wagging the dog.
Yeah. That, okay. In that situation.
All right.
Thank you, Jim.
Further argument from Ms. Palmer.
May it please the court. I represent Floyd Gray. My name is Charles Dickens of Fort Worth. Floyd Gray was elected in the general election 1978, and was sworn into office January 1 of 79. His term would expire December the 31st of 82. He's in the same position as seven other respondents in this case. Some of the other people in the case as involuntary defendants in the lawsuit had never taken office. Now, at no time in our pleadings, in the trial of the case, or before the Court of Appeals, if we tried to persuade anyone, the commissioners did not have the power and the authority to redistrict. They did. Our position has been throughout that an elected office is a property right that is recognized and will be enforced by the courts. The method of redistricting is in Article 5, Section 18 of the Constitution, and as Mr. Chapman said, for the convenience of the people. But that same article provides a four-year term of office for justice of the peace and constables. Now, the Constitution also provides a way to remove a person from office other than the voters removing him at an election. And that is Article 5, Section 24 of the Constitution. And this deals also with JPs, constables, and other county offices. And it states that they may be removed by judges of district courts for specific causes that are defined by the law and not by any other method. Now, in redistricting, the legislature had passed Article 2351 and a half. And among other things, it stated prior to the 1981 amendment, which happened after we tried our case, that for commissioners, if redistricting put the commissioner outside of his precinct boundaries, he would then stay in office, though, regardless if he lived in the commissioner's precinct or not. Well, since we tried this case, the 67th legislature amended that particular provision of 2351.5 to include justice, peace, and constables, treating them the same as commissioners. And I can see the rationale behind that, because in effect, the legislature was codifying existing case law, that it is a property right that cannot be taken away arbitrarily by redistricting. And it makes sense. And in answer to the question, this same thing can never happen again, because of the way the legislature now has changed Article 2351.5, because now it states that these officers shall remain on the job even though they live outside the precinct line. So this would never come up again. And of course, at the same time, the legislature repealed Section 3 of 2351.5, because it is what caused a lot of problems in this lawsuit, I'm sure. Now, I'd like to point out some of the cases that the petitioner is relying on. First, the case of Dowling versus Rigsby. Originally, the appellate court decided that quo warranto was not a proper remedy. But be that as it may, they decided to go ahead and render an opinion, which to me smacks somewhat of an advisory opinion. And it dealt with boundary changes, not abolition of office as such, but it was boundary changes that took away part of one precinct and gave it to another person. But the party happened to live in the other precinct. But that case also, even though I do think it's advisory, it acknowledges that an office is property. And that's what we're here about today. And it doesn't really hold, as the petitioner states. The Moore and Tellis cases he cites out of the El Paso court dealt with people who had never taken the oath of office. In other words, when they were elected to an office that did not exist at that time under redistricting, and they never took the oath of office. Well, these eight respondents in this particular case did take the oath of office. They were serving and had served 2 years. Now, a distinction might could be made between the ones that had taken the office and the ones that had not. I don't know. The fact in this case, and it's all in the record, is that the political process had been at work in Tarrant County, Texas. People had run on both the Republican and the Democratic ticket for nominations to office. The commissioners chose, at some time after that, to redistrict for a time in the future. The statute clearly sets out 2351.5, that if it is done before redistricting is done before an election, then the folks can run for those jobs that will take effect in the future. But they redistricted between the political process of the primaries and the general election, and hence we were in the trial court and now we're here. The appellate court in this particular case, on page 8 of the opinion, made an observation which I think is very pertinent to these type of cases. In upholding the judgment of the trial court, the appellate court at Fort Worth stated, says, an unbridled power to divest precinct office holders in midterm for convenience of the people could invite political chicanery and undermine the electoral process and the will of the voters. That's exactly what can happen, and it's what perhaps happened. But I would still like to point out, because the waived. The law was amended by the 67th legislature. While it might not particularly help us, we're not relying on it to help. That cannot happen again because the legislature has seen what the problem is and they have solved it. Thank you very much.
Further argument? Here, rebuttal argument from petitioner.
Thank you.
The respondents place some reliance upon the case of Childress County versus Saxby, which is, of course, a case involving commissioners' precincts. There is a fundamental difference between commissioners' precincts and justice precincts. The fundamental difference is that the Constitution says there shall be 4 commissioners' precincts, not 5, not 6, not 2, not 11, not 12, 4. There can only be 4. You can never have more, you can never have less. With regard to justices of the peace, the Constitution says you may have as few as 4 and you may have as many as 8. The Constitution vests the authority of the Commissioner's Court to set the number. Clearly, if a county has 8 justice precincts, the Commissioner's Court of that county has the power to reduce the number of precincts to 4. And in so doing, it is entirely possible that you will move from having 8 justices of the peace, or as many perhaps as 16 justices of the peace, to as few as 4 justices of the peace, or as many as 8 justices of the peace, depending upon the population within the respective precincts and the cities therein. At the same time, you would obviously move from having 8 constables to 4 constables. There is no provision in the Constitution for having place 1 and place 2 office of constable. The question raised by the respondent with regard to you can take my property but you have to pay for it, I think, is a rabbit trail down which the respondents led both trial court and the Court of Appeals. The ability to abolish the office is clearly given by the Constitution. One can take, or the Commissioner's Court can abolish this office. One can be removed from office by impeachment and is given due process of law. I believe that the respondent's argument is that I have it, it's mine. You can follow the Constitution all you want, but you're still going to have to pay me because there's a provision that says you cannot take my property without just compensation. And this argument applies equally well to impeachment or removal under Article 5, Section 24 of the Constitution. Certainly you can take it. You can take it in the way the Constitution and the law allows, which is exactly what the respondents have said here, but you still have to pay me for it, because you can't take my property without just compensation. That clearly is not the law in this state, in this case, with regard to these matters. They speak of their property rights. I again avert to the opinion of the Attorney General 790, which, as respondents pointed out, was there have been subsequent writings by the Attorney General number 564 and number 220. We believe that in both 564 and 220, the Attorney General got things a little wrong. He read Childress County versus Saxby case and decided that commissioners or commissioners' court precincts are about the same as justice court precincts, which they are not. Further, at that time, there was the decision of the United States District Court for the Southern District of Texas in Moore versus the El Paso County Commissioner's Court, Moore versus the Harris County Commissioner's Court. Subsequently, the United States Supreme Court decided that the federal district court had no business trying to decide unsettled questions of state law and should have abstained. in those cases. And again, averting back to 790, there it is said, in quoting from Carver versus Wheeler County, which is found at 200 Southwest 537, a decision of the Amarillo Court of Civil Appeals that has no writ history. While the holder of a public office is vested with certain rights in reference thereto, being entitled to hold the same and receive the emoluments and compensation incident to the discharge of the duties of the office, and may defend his rights against others, yet the relation between the office holder and the government under which he holds office is not that of employer and employee, and their respective rights are not to be determined by the application of the general rules of contracts of employment. So that it is universally held that in the absence of some inhibition by some superior law, the governing body may abolish the office or change the compensation to be paid to the office holder at any time, even during the term of the office of an incumbent, provided, of course, the changed rate of compensation cannot be made to apply to services already rendered. In this case, the respondents who do not hold office ask this court to sanction the payment to them of salaries and benefits where they perform no service. Clearly, we believe that the public policy of this state is against doing that. The Constitution itself provides the legislature shall make law to, in essence, penalize an officer to reduce his salary if his work is not performed. In the case of State Ex Rel Dowland versus Rigsby, question again was presented as to the term of office established in the Constitution. It says they hold their office for 2 years. The complaint was made there that you can't make any changes at all during my term. The court said that the power to establish the precincts does not necessarily conflict with the provision fixing the term of office. They must stand together. The office is taken subject to the power to change the boundaries of the precincts. This is no anomaly in the law. While the office is property, it is held subject to the power to the proper exercise of all such powers as these. The justices of the peace and constables of this state hold their office subject to the power granted by the people to their commissioners' courts to make such changes as are necessary for the convenience of the people from time to time. The Court of Appeals has said, if we grant to commissioners' courts the power that the Constitution expressly gives them, they might abuse it. And so we are not going to give them that power. We are going to say that they cannot do what they have done. While it may be the opinion of those justices that the grant of power may lead to abuse, and while that may actually be true in given instances, that feeling, that perception, that fear does not authorize the changing of the organic law of this state. The Constitution provides the power to the commissioners' courts to make these changes, and they have done so. The Constitution, as interpreted by the courts of this state, does not protect an office holder from the proper exercise of the powers granted in the Constitution. This case must be reversed. We ask the court to do so. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted on written briefs and oral argument for both parties. You're excused from counsel, please.
Thank you.
1968.
60, pardon. Then you're talking about now a deed in 1971. Now, does this suit involve the validity? Are you trying to enforce the two original deeds or the 71 deed or all three of them?
What I think we have is the two deeds in 68 put legal title in code. In 1971, they had an oral partition of the properties that they had acquired. Now the two deeds in 71, he put legal title in Cove, and with that legal title then, he could enforce the ultimate division that they had agreed upon. And when he gave the deed in 1971, that the purpose of it was to complete the partition that they had contemplated from the beginning. As Manger says, they were divided along agreeable lines. And the agreeable lines were what they agreed to in 1971. So the 1971 deed then would have, if it had been corrected and returned, would have resulted in Cove having a deed to exactly one half of everything in the BCG and MDS land that Magnuson acquired. But having not returned it, a corrected deed, title to everything remains in Cove, so far as the Venerable Magnuson is concerned. But we, in our pleadings, we were confronted with this proposition. By this time, we had a situation where they had had an oral partition of this property, and it had been carried out in all things except with respect to these mineral deeds. There had been full performance by Mr. Cook. He paid the full $2,200,000. He had received the deed from Magnus after the service he was to receive. And he had had a promise of a conveyance of a half of the mineral. And he had had an effort to convey it. So we were confronted with the proposition that ordinarily you do not have to plead the equities of your adversary. But when the equities of the adversary become so involved in your own rights, and the things you have to assert for yourself, that in order to keep from misleading the court, you have to plead the rights of the adversary. Then we did acknowledge the fact of where we were on this thing, that the deed in 68 was to guarantee we got what they had partitioned among themselves.
Well, does your case rest on the holding of these 1968 deeds as present conveyances as distinguished from security interest in 10?
Oh, yes. Certainly, I think it would rest on both. Certainly, no question about it being a present conveyance, because if you read the deed itself, it says, it is the intention of the grantor to convey to the grantee all of the interest he has in these properties.
As I understand, the Court of Civil Appeals said parole evidence was missed was showed that the intent was security, not present conveyance. If the intent was security,
yes.
Do you still maintain your rights in are lost, or do you plead also for the adjudication of security?
Well, it could, if you consider all of our points, Mr. Atlas will consider those constructive trust points. It could be accomplished in one of two ways. We recognize in our pleadings that legal title should be in us, and we recognize that Magnus is entitled to an equity of a half interest in what we're holding legal title to. So whether you say it's just based on security, or whether you once you recognize what they have agreed to is that these minerals are owned 50-50, then it becomes a matter of semantics which way you go, whether you say it's a matter of security or a matter of legal title being in a Cook with a trust in favor of Magnus, or legal title in Magnus with trust in favor of Cook. The facts are clear, I think, that the legal title, the minerals are to be divided.
Now, is it your position, counsel, that the agreement to partition is not subject to the statute of frauds because of part performance, or because the agreement was in writing?
Well, I would say both. The when you have part performance, and there are any number of things that are taken out of the statute of fraud, part performance, unjust enrichment, and then of course we contend that the legal title was never this oral partition that they made in 1971 did not have the effect of divesting Cole or Cook of legal title to the minerals any more than it had the effect of divesting Mangus of title to the surface, which they had partitioned among themselves.
What is the date and name of the instrument that you say reflects the agreement in writing?
Well, of course, the two deeds in 1968 and the deed in 1971. The deed in 1971 confirmed that the intent was that...
Any of those three deeds have a memorandum of what the agreement was? Or you say there's just evidence that there wasn't?
They're just conveyances, absolute on their face. But, of course, Cole, having elected to assert its legal title, which I think it had to do, recognized that there were... Having recognized that there were equities in Mangus' favor, that's as far as they have to go, and that's all they have to do to Mr. Mangus. They have recognized that he has these equities. They're willing to concede those equities to him. They don't have to go ahead. They don't have to plead it for him any further. They don't have to brief it for him. They don't have to put it in every point that they allege. It's present in every point because Cole has acknowledged it. Now, the
counsel, who instituted this suit?
That's a difficult question. It was originally instituted by Mr. Mangus against Reuben Garrett to cancel the lease he had given, and that was pending. And when they discovered that Mangus was treating the title to these minerals as his own, Mr. Cook was waiting for him to comply with the by returning another deed. When he saw he was dealing with it as his own, then Cook intervened in the suit that was pending.
Now, what relief did Cook ask for in his intervention?
Well, in his intervention, he asked for the live pleading, I think is attached to a rebuttal brief. He asked for either legal title, for legal title with a trust in favor of Mangus, or if the court should find that legal title of Mangus, then a trust should be declared in favor of the court. That's roughly it. And I believe that's the way it's looking. Thank you, gentlemen.
Further argument from the petition?
May it please the court. I essentially intend to argue the constructive trust theory of this case, but I do want to say that this is an alternate argument in the event the court should find for some reason that the two deeds of 1968, two mental deeds of December 1968, are not operative to vest legal title in Mr. Cook. I will use for purposes of description Cook rather than Cole because Mr. Mangus does admit in his affidavit everybody agrees that Cook is Cole and Cole is Cook. Those two deeds were on their face conveyances of the minerals in the BCG and MGS lands, the two tracts of land about which we speak. They did not involve the surface. I think in answer, Judge Stakely, to a number of these questions, it would be good to because it goes to both the constructive trust argument as well as the matter of where title lies in this case, to both tracts involving minerals, to look at the virtually undisputed facts. This is a summary judgment case. What we have in terms of facts outside of the documents themselves are affidavits. And I think it's essential that the court know exactly what is in those affidavits. There are two affidavits in this file, in this record, by Clinton Mangus. And this is what they say. His first affidavit was executed in February 9th, 1976. The next one that I'll read was dated March 8th, 1976, 1 month apart. Prior to December 10th, 1968, I had entered into a joint arrangement and agreement with Vannie E. Cook Jr. of McAllen, Texas, whereby he and I together were to purchase certain of the Guerra properties that were available for purchase. We entered into a binding agreement undertaking to make these acquisitions and then to partition them after they were made and to divide them along agreeable lines. A lot of the language that Smith was using was not his own language, it was Mr. Mangus's language. There were many stipulations and agreements contained in our contract, and we proceeded to and did enter into such agreement and carried the agreement forward from 1968 until sometime in 1972, at which time we had acquired properties in excess of $2 million. The properties acquired included ranches as well as mineral interests in and through the Guerra lands, or as it's known popularly, called the M. Guerra and Sons property in Starr County, Texas. During the course of our joint arrangement, Mr. Cook had requested that in some of the conveyances that evidence be made of our joint arrangement by having me simply execute, for simplicity, instruments reflecting joint ownership and interest, such as the two documents dated December 10, 1968. Now that's essential to an understanding of this case, whether you go on the his intent, which he later denies that it was intended to transfer title, he says, or any interest to the minerals. Nonetheless, during the course of our joint arrangement, Mr. Cook requested in some of the conveyances that evidence be made of our joint arrangement by having me simply execute for simplicity instruments reflecting joint ownership and interest. Now that's out of the mouth of Clinton Mangus. 1 month later, I realize this is a summary judgment case. I envision this as a man testifying one day in a lawsuit, testifying the next day exactly the opposite. Let me read it. Mr. Mangus says in March of 1968, prior to December 10, 1968, Cove Investments and or Vannie Cook were one and the same to me, and I treated them as such. I had many transactions with Vannie Cook and or Cove Investments, Inc., all of which were handled in my name. This is for purchase of constructed trucks. They were divided in about three categories, however. Those where I would buy land in my name in which Vannie Cook or Cove Investments would have an interest, those which I would buy in my name in which I alone would have an interest, and those which I would buy in my name alone in which Vannie Cook and I would have a joint interest. There was never any finalized, enforceable agreement or understanding between me and Vannie Cook and or Cove Investments that he, Vannie Cook, and or Cove would have any interest whatsoever in the Guerra land purchase. As a matter of fact, it was understood and agreed the Guerra purchase was my sole acquisition and my sole lead, and that was our understanding. Now, if anybody can reconcile those two statements, it has to be with mirrors. Two affidavits, 1 month apart. I submit that it, for summary judgment purposes, and this goes purely to the question of rendition, if we're successful.
I'm going to inquire, assuming we agree with your position, what disposition should we make? Will we make this a remand, general remand?
Your Honor, I would say that if he had only the second affidavit, and if you were going on the constructive trust theory, if you were not to hold that the two mineral deeds of 1968 were absolute on the face, for some reason that, as the Court of Civil Appeals can be, and I admit this is an established rule of construction, that a deed absolute on its face can be modified by virtue of oral testimony if it was intended as something other than a deed. Where does the testimony come from here to modify the deed? He says in the first instance, any question, we had a joint arrangement. I would say in answer to your question, Judge Stakely, that the court would have a perfect right to render this case on the basis of this testimony if, in fact, as they say in their brief, there was no intention to convey in 1968, for the reason that you have two Mr. Manguses testifying. If I had the man on the stand in one day in a case, and he testified our joint arrangement, no question, Mr. Cook, for simplicity, I gave it to him to demonstrate our joint arrangement. He wanted an interest in the property. It so denominated it. The next day he testified, well, I really didn't intend to convey anything. If I made a motion for instructed verdict on the basis of that testimony, I think I would be entitled to it. Therefore, I say on the basis of that, Your Honor, we would be entitled to a rendition. When you get to constructive trust, you may well have a different situation, which I will discuss. I wanted to set these facts out before the court unmistakably, because it goes to both arguments. Constructive trust at this point, there may be 15 or 20 cases, the court's all familiar with them, involving constructive trust in the state of Texas. What are the requirements of constructive trust? If the court were to say, Mr. Mangus has legal title. If for some reason it says that, which I do not in any way
admit I do not understand the theory of the Court of Civil Appeals saying, we have the deeds, but you can modify them by oral testimony to show that they are in fact a guarantee of performance, which is what Mr. Cook honestly said he thought it was, a guarantee of his performance. That doesn't mean that they're a nullity. You don't then say, well, you can't have your performance. But then the gigantic leap forward is, well, the agreement to convey the minerals is oral, therefore, it's barred by the statute of fraud. Constructive trust in Texas is provided in instances where there is a breach of a fiduciary or confidential relationship, as the court knows. Furthermore, and there are elements under that which I'll discuss, furthermore, it's provided in the case of actual fraud, and you don't have to have a confidential fiduciary relationship. This court has held time immemorial, time and again, that you need not have a technical fiduciary relationship, that you must have some kind of a relationship from the past, but not only that, but that continues on into this transaction. And I submit that Mr. Mangus' own testimony, without regard to Mr. Cook's affidavits, which were in this file and very clear in this record, that Mr. Mangus' own testimony creates the confidential relationship, gives testimony to it, carries it forward from prior similar transactions, land transactions, taken into his name with Mr. Cook's money. He never denied anything in Mr. Cook's affidavit. The court will look at it. He does not in any way, shape, or form deny what Mr. Cook says, that these deeds were given in 1968. In 1971, there was this partition according to what he says was the agreement. They partitioned the surface. Back to constructive trust. Here we have all of the elements of constructive trust, either by breach of fiduciary relationship, as testified to by Mr. Mangus and by Mr. Cook, incidentally, and further, by actual fraud. Why do I say fraud in addition to the fiduciary relationship? Because in his affidavit, 8 years later, he comes back and says, I never intended that it conveyed anything to him. Which means, back then, I never intended Mr. Cook to get any of his money. The truth of the matter is, constructive trust can be applied in either of these instances, either for the breach of the fiduciary relationship, the confidential relationship. All of the elements are in this case. Trust by Mr. Cook. Mr. Mangus saying we used to take these things together all the time. And Mr. Mangus saying we did in fact have a business arrangement with regard to the surface and the minerals in this case. Gave him a deed to it, two deeds. Why? What he says for simplicity. He gave it because Mr. Cook wanted it to protect himself. Now, to constructive trust, they argue, that belies confidence because he got something in writing. Had he got in writing what would have belied confidence, it would have been a 30-page document of all of this. The Baker's case out of Dallas says that not only can you have constructive trust because of a confidential relationship, you can buttress the confidential relationship with instruments in writing, even though they themselves might not be enforceable, as there was a question about it in the Baker's case. But they may be used to show the confidential relationship and the breach thereof. And that's exactly what we have. The legal title, in answer to your question, we believe rests in Cove and in Cook. Without any question, when you deliver those instruments, title can't be in limbo. Title is somewhere. Legal title to the minerals were in Cook. Without any question. What we are saying, and our pleas were clear in the trial court, what we're saying now is clear. We are saying that if this court enforces those mineral deeds, there's no reason not to. If they're security for performance, we're entitled to use them as security for performance and keep them as absolute conveyances. There's no distinction that ought to be made between conveyances today and a conveyance for security purposes. If it was a guaranteed performance, it doesn't render it a nullity, and that seems to be what the court is saying. That seems to be what the opposition is saying. Yeah, we say...
Your time is up. I want to ask a question to keep you along.
All right.
I heard both of you and your co-counsel say that you used Mr. Cook's money, $2 million. I haven't heard whether you said it was an investment or whether it was a loan from Cook to Mangus.
Mr. Mangus says it was a joint arrangement to buy it together. Mr. Cook says, in all fairness, I was to have an option to acquire. For purposes of constructive trust, it makes no difference. For purposes of title, it doesn't, because they actually partitioned the surface and he attempted to deliver a deed which was incorrect on the minerals.
It might make some difference to me if the money was borrowed to buy the land, which could be repaid.
The agreement was this, Your Honor, under the affidavits, that Mr. Cook would extend all of the funds As a matter of fact, by December of 68, when he got the deeds, he had extended a couple of million dollars. He was to extend further funds. At the time that they were to do their partition, Mr. Cook was to get his money back and be entitled to buy one half of everything acquired at cost. The evidence shows in affidavits that the $2,200,000 he paid, that of that approximately $1,466,000 applied to the 27,000 acres. The balance of $700,000 or $800,000 was to apply to the minerals, and in fact, Mr. Mangus was paid for the minerals. And that's what's in dispute. No delivery of a half interest in the minerals, or as we say, either title is found in Cook, then impose a constructive trust in favor of Mr. Mangus for it, which Mr. Cook has offered to do for the one half, or if for some reason legal title is found in Mr. Mangus, impose a constructive trust because of the producer relationship, etc., for Mr. Cook, the one half.
Thank you.
Counsel, hear argument from Mr. Palmer.
May it please the court, Mr. Daniel Hagen and Mr. Larry Patton will present argument for respondent. Mr. Hagen, welcome.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Daniel Hedges, and I'm counsel for the respondent Bank of the Southwest National Association. I'd like to introduce to the court Mr. Larry Patton, who is counsel for the respondent Clinton Mangus, Helen Mangus, and Duval County Ranch Company. The respondent would like to address four principal points before the court today. Those are, first, the uncontestable fact that the 1968 deeds were not intended to be and could not be present conveyances. Second, that the 1971 oral option agreement between Cove and Mangus was in contravention of the statute of fraud.
Pardon me, counsel, but so that I'll have your argument in context, what's the Bank of the Southwest doing in this case?
We're a lien holder, Your Honor.
From whom?
From Mr. and Mrs. Mangus. We stand largely in the shoes of the bank.
You put up some of the money also?
Your Honor, there are several different places where the bank becomes involved here. The bank did put up some of the money. The bank was brought in by Cove on the basis of a second loan which was made by the bank to Mr. and Mrs. Mangus, and the bank received in turn a lien on certain of the properties that are involved before the court today. So we freely admit to the court we stand largely in the shoes of Mr. and Mrs. Mangus.
In other words, after Mangus acquired the property, he went out and borrowed money from you to place the lien on the property.
Your Honor, there are about two different transactions here. One of them was back in 1971, and this is out of the pleading to Cove, where I believe Mr. Smith referred to this earlier, there was the meeting at the bank, and Cook was fully involved and fully aware of precisely what was going on there, where the bank received a security interest in a portion of the property at that time. Subsequently, another loan was made back, I believe, in 1974, after most of these properties had been acquired. A loan was made to Mr. and Mrs. Mangus, and the bank received a further security interest as a result of that loan.
Counsel, in the matter now before us, is the position of the bank and the position of Mangus identical?
I do not know of any differences. I don't want to presume to speak totally for Mr. Mangus on their position, but I don't know of any difference, Your Honor. I think you can safely assume that they are identical. The third point we'd like to present to the court, and this is quite a critical one because it has been argued before the court today, is that Cove has waived irrevocably its constructive trust arguments by failing to raise them until its amended motion for rehearing in the Court of Civil Appeals. Our fourth point is, in the event the court decides to consider the constructive trust argument, the court should find that in an absence of a fiduciary relationship between Cove and Mangus, a constructive trust could not be imposed. Mr. Patton will address the fourth point dealing with the merits of a constructive trust. I will address the first three points dealing with the deed not being a present conveyance, statute of fraud, and the waiver of the constructive trust issues. Turning to the first point, that the 1968, and I want to make it very clear to the court, we're talking about the 1968 two mineral deeds. Those were not intended to be by anyone and could not have been present conveyances of what Cove now seeks to acquire by virtue of those deeds. There's been considerable talk and reading from the affidavits of Mr. Mangus. The court can completely put aside the depositions of Mr. Mangan. The trial court did not even, in the Court of Civil Appeals, did not have to make any reference to those affidavits whatsoever to arrive at the decision that these deeds were not intended to be present conveyances, because all the court has to have reference to is the affidavit of Mr. Vanny Cook, who is the alter ego of Cove Investments. It is extremely clear from Mr. Cook's affidavit, and we set forth the language in some detail in our supplemental brief, that Mr. Cook knew perfectly well that these deeds were not present conveyances, were not intended to be present conveyances, but they solely were a security for the advancement of monies from him to Mangus to purchase certain of these lands. Very briefly quoting from that, Cook has said that something to show present and future good faith on Mangus' part was desirable if I was to continue this financial assistance to him, and he knew it.
Counsel, if they were intended for as a security, what is your comment? Did that support a constructive trust?
No, Your Honor, and we'd respond to that in two ways. First, they could have at least made the argument before the trial court, before the Court of Civil Appeals, that they supported a constructive trust, but they didn't make that argument. The motion for summary judgment says we want enforcement of the two deeds. I urge the court to look to the points of error, which Cove says do support a constructive trust argument. Look to the briefing in the Court of Civil Appeals, which Cove says supports a constructive trust argument. It doesn't. It has absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with it. So our first point, Your Honor, is that those arguments are waived. They're simply not before this court. Mr. Patton will address in his 10 minutes before the court the details of the constructive trust issue if the court sees fit to reach that issue. But I'll go into this in more detail later, but it simply isn't before the court.
If these instruments were intended as guaranteed, probably a gross illustration, but deed of trust is the same purpose, isn't it? And you're fair about it. You convey a deed of trust, you don't really intend on conveying away your title. It's just to secure the note. This was intended as a guarantee to see if he carried out the agreement, wasn't it?
Your Honor, what they're trying
to convey.
They're certainly trying to say it was a conveyance, Your Honor. That's their principal point here.
Smith argued that. Why couldn't it be a mere fact that it's given as security? Why couldn't it be a conveyance if you, I get the whole list and do you pay off, you comply with this agreement?
Your Honor, it couldn't be a conveyance of what they say it conveys for two reasons. One of those reasons is that we have a judicial admission from Mr. Cook in his affidavit that it wasn't. And number one, they admit via their affidavit that it was not a present conveyance. The second reason why it couldn't be a present conveyance, Your Honor, is that you can't convey what you don't have. And that's precisely what they're talking about here. I refer the court to the operative pleading of Cove, and what they ask for is, as against defendant Clinton Mangus, for title and possession of the entire undivided interest in minerals in the MGS and V.C. Guerra estate lands, plus executive rights to lease the entire minerals of said land to the extent they were acquired by defendant Mangus. I'd refer back to the very first question asked by Justice Staple here today, which was, in 1968, did Mangus have the minerals which he sought, which supposedly they're saying he's being conveyed? He had some mineral rights in these lands in 1968, but the pleadings before this court make it very clear that additional mineral rights were acquired in 1971, and the final mineral rights were not acquired until the conclusion of the litigation in 1974. So we have Cove on the one hand saying,
was there a warranty deed? Was there a warranty on this conveyance from Mangus to Cook?
A warranty deed, Your Honor?
Warranty. Could these after-acquired properties pass under the warranty?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. They said it was a present conveyance at that time. And then, of course, subsequently, as the court understands from the argument, subsequent agreements were entered into, although they were oral, unenforceable agreements under the statute of fraud, to try to acquire a completely different deal, in effect.
The 68 deeds were general warranty deeds on the face?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. And that, in essence, is the point on the deeds not being a present conveyance. Number one, it's most critical, the court does not have to look to Mangus' affidavit, there's a great deal of briefing about how Mr. Mangus was obviously lying and giving falsehoods and that kind of thing. None of that's properly before the court. Because the court does not need to go beyond the affidavit of Vannie Cook, which contains a judicial admission, which thereby cannot be contradicted, that these were intended solely as a security. And furthermore, it couldn't have been a present conveyance at that time, because they couldn't convey what they didn't have.
But in your opinion, where are we if this was intended as a guarantee of performance as security? Where are we?
We are, Your Honor, at the status quo, which is these things belong to Mangus with a lien in favor of the bank, because no constructive trust argument was presented or preserved in the courts below. On the one hand, they weren't present conveyances, and on the other hand, an argument perhaps could have been made. Mr. Patton can address the merits of it and show that it wouldn't have been a successful argument. Arguments could have at least been made that these were a security, which is what Hove, at least in his affidavit, states they were. But this argument wasn't made. It's been waived. In effect, what Cove has done, Your Honor, is to
Is it possible? I'm trying to understand. If there were not a deed, do you contend they were a mortgage?
No, we certainly do not, Your Honor. And no contention has been made.
Does Mangus claim it was a mortgage? I guess we'll have to let him speak.
I think that's correct, Your Honor, but I don't believe it. I'd prefer to have Mangus counsel answer that.
I'd like to have one or the other.
Your Honor, they could have been, under certain circumstances, some kind of a security. But
what other kind of security is there?
I beg your pardon?
What other kind of security is there?
Well, both, I'm going to defer to his counsel to discuss this with the court in detail, but if not, I would stress, and I can't stress this too much, that all of these are very interesting questions. They simply aren't before the court. They were not presented.
Well,
but, Your Honor,
let me reassign that.
Yes, sir, that's certainly correct, obviously. Let me turn to the waiver point and say why we're urging this so strongly on the court. I think it's quite fair for this court and the courts below to say a line has to be drawn somewhere, that before a certain point is reached, you've got to make your argument. You can't keep bringing in new points and bringing in new arguments.
Counsel, are you saying that they didn't raise it because the word constructive trust was not used?
Oh, no, Your Honor, not at all.
Did they not ask in the pleadings and also in the Court of Civil Appeals for an equitable interest in the event that they were not found to be?
No, Your Honor. In their pleadings, they do. In their final pleadings, they do get around to that point finally. And I would point out to the court, in relating to your response here, that one of the things that was argued both in the briefs and before the court today was that the only reason that they brought up the business about this being security and not being a present conveyance, the 1968 deed, was because they were offering to do equity. They had the alternative equitable argument. I would point out to the court that the affidavit from Vannie Cook, which makes it very clear that they were intended as security and not as a present conveyance, was filed prior to Cove ever making the constructive trust argument. They didn't make those arguments initially. Only after these facts have come out in the Cook affidavit that they then come in with a